record this session also for those people who can't attend. So first, I'm going to talk slightly about this course, how this course is taught, what you are supposed to learn in here, and how you are supposed to study during this course. Then I'm trying to motivate you a little bit why this might be an interesting topic for you to study. Apparently, you all already feel like it's an interesting topic since there's so many of you here. Then I give you a very short introduction to Haskell, very bird's eye view. Haskell is the language that we are going to use in this course. And then I make a very quick and hasty overview of the topics in the early part of the course, those topics that I expect you to learn basically this week. And finally, we are going to have some kind of practical hassles. We try to make this a group work course. So I hope that most of you will find some friends here and can, you know, support each other and do these exercises that I give you in a group. So, another thing is that I try always to make some kind of a small scientific work about my way of teaching and these peculiar kinds of courses that I hold. So if you can, please take time to fill in that survey. If you can't copy the URL from the slides, I already emailed that to you. And I will explain later why it's actually quite important that you fill out these silly surveys that we all make in our courses. So, first, how to study in this course? I mean, I'm very impressed that this course is interesting for so many people. And there is this one nice aspect in teaching functional programming. Functional programming is not the programming one course. I don't have to make this course perfect every time. I can make all kinds of nice experiments with this course. So if you fail programming one or fail programming two, basically your whole career is ruined. If you fail functional programming, well, okay, it hurts, but it's not critical. So I can try to make this course very nice by doing something experimental, which might turn out to be not so nice. So first, I have this course staff. I'm Ville Tirronen, and we have Samuel Uusimäkelä there, who has been TAing this course for at least once already, perhaps twice. Then we have Matti Eskelinen from physics department, also interested in these topics. Also Tommy Lundberg, who studied the course last year and was willing to come and share his knowledge with us. And finally, we have Samsa Kiiskinen, not listed on the slides. He will be TAing the second functional programming course. So all the difficult topics will be his troubles. And what do you want to do with these teaching assistants that I have? All practical questions. Just find one of these gentlemen and ask him. Any technical question, find one of these gentlemen and ask him about it. So they are here to basically serve your every need. They might disagree, but that's exactly why they were hired. So I'm making this course with the assumption that you have a goal. You have some reason to be here. You didn't fill out the survey yet, so I have no idea what your goal actually is. So I'll just suppose your goal is to learn functional programming because it's a trendy topic and everyone is talking about it right now. I think you are here because you like programming and want to be even better programmers. And finally, some of you might be here because you want to learn how to think in a more abstract and more high-level way. Also a goal for this course. So everyone agree with me. These are your goals. Yeah, at least one person agreed with me, so I'm doing fine. So, my goal. I have goals also. So I want to teach you not so much Haskell or functional programming. I want to teach you abstract thinking. Because that is a skill that computer scientists in our department usually don't develop as far as they could. We don't really like math. We don't that much like formal notation. We never find out why studying things like logic and proofs is actually good for us. So I try to change this a little bit. Second is that I want to push you out of your zone of comfort. So I'm going to make you do hard things in this course. Of course, that hurts because thinking scientifically hurts. But basically, I think you will all benefit from this. So I want to make you think harder than you have thought in the previous courses you have taken. unless you have taken advanced math. I don't want to explode your brain if I push you that far. And my third goal is do all of this without causing you very high levels of stress. So I'm going to make a stress-free course, something that you can just enjoy and attend and still get pushed out of your zone of comfort. So the last part. Why do I list a non-stressful course as, you know, my goal? I did a software security course over the summer. I didn't do this, and it was a horrible course. So I don't want to stress you, and this actually comes from a scientific theory by Ryan and Desi called the self-determination theory, which says that people have two kinds of motivations. You have this external motivation. If I say, you get candy if you do all the exercises, and I will hit you with a stick if you don't, that is external motivation. And supposing that you want the candy and don't want the stick, you are going to, you know, work hard on the course. But it's going to be very tiring for you because it's not fun. It's a job you have to do. You always need to think about, can I spend time on learning this topic or should I just return the exercise as fast as I can? So we don't want these kind of external motivators in this course. Basically, I want you to study because studying is actually fun. Another kind of motivation in this self-determination theory is intrinsic motivation. That is basically a very nice thing. You do stuff that you want to do. And if you do stuff that you want to do instead of wanting to avoid getting hit by a stick, you are going to be more efficient. You are going to learn better. You are going to learn faster. And even if you spend a lot of hours in learning the stuff, you are not probably going to get tired because it's actually fun. So how do I try to avoid this extrinsic motivation and trying to, you know, make you do all these things because I tell you? So I don't have any exams. So I try to avoid stressing you out so that, you know, the ordinary course model. You study for 3 months, you think you are doing well, then you go to the exam and get 0 points. And there goes your allowance, there goes your Kela benefits, and your life is ruined for a few months. So I won't do that. I don't even give out grades unless you are a foreign student and your home university desperately needs a grade. Then I will give you a grade. So I don't want you to study because you want to please me and get a higher grade. So I want you to study the things that you are interested in. So you don't get the grade, you get a pass and fail. I'm forced to give credits during this course. I tried to suggest to my boss that I wouldn't give any credits. And he suggested me that I wouldn't get any pay, so I have to give you credits. I don't even have a carved in stone schedule. The course starts today and ends at a given date, but you can, you know, study at your own pace. So if you want to take longer on certain subjects than others, you can. If you want to go faster, you can. We are all probably in quite different skill ranges here. I know that there are some who are really beginners. I know that there are others who have studied functional programming before. So it's silly to actually make you all go in the same place. So all of these are designed to take away the external nasty motivation that is going to make you tired. Things I want you to do or things I do on my lectures, I try to promote studying in groups. So if you study with your friends, you have more fun, and you know this effect. You are feeling very tired, you know that you should study, but you probably won't study. And then your friend calls and says, hey, do you want to study with me about this topic? And then you have energy to study again. So I try to promote this, and my TAs will try to promote this. Second thing I do is I trust you to study. So basically I fully acknowledge that since I take away these external motivators and some of the deadlines, it is going to lead to a situation where you have to, you know, exert your self-direction a bit more than usual. But that's okay, you're all adults, you can, you know, manage your own time, and I completely trust that you will study the necessary amount in this course. The necessary amount is very high, by the way. I let you choose your own pace, like I said. I try to give feedback one way or another on every exercise that you make. So you return exercises. We won't have any model answers to check the exercises. Instead, we try to grade each and every submission that you make. And finally, I'm going to throw tennis balls at you, which is to say that if I want to make Finnish students talk in class, I have to do something drastic. So basically, we are going to have in-class discussions on the lectures. So we discuss about the topics, try to ensure that everyone knows what we are talking about and so on. It's usually fun, but requires a bit of mental adjustment. So when you come to the next lecture, it won't be a monologue like this one. I make you talk or discuss slightly during the lecture. So if that worries you, just, you know, I don't know, take some anti-worry pill or something when you come here. So, and that's things I don't do and things I do. Passing the course. Since I take away the exams and I take away the grades, how do you pass the course? I have to give credits, and I give credits according to the fact that have you done all the exercises. And by all, I mean every single exercise. So first you do all the exercises, then you convince me or one of my teaching assistants that it was actually you and not some other guy that you just paid for the exercises. I mean, basically go to a TA and say that I did these, and he's going to ask you one question. It's basically, what does this symbol mean in your code? Very simple, very informal. But there is a catch. If you won't or can't do everything, you still get credits. If you do just the exercises for credit one, I'll show you where you find them soon, you get one credit. If you do exercises for credits one and two, you get two credits and so on. So you don't lose work. You study as far as you can go. If you can't complete the entire course, that's fine. You get still a few credits and you can come back next year and complete the rest. And what does this actually mean? I mean, it sounds very simple. You have to just, you know, do all the exercises and you're done. What is difficult in this, and I mean difficult, is that last year I got something like 80 students who registered for my course, and 30 students who actually got any credits, is that you have to be very precise with your scheduling. You have to reserve time. I won't, you know, reserve time for you. You have to be self-directed, so you have to make your own deadlines and own goals. If you don't do this, usually what happens is that you come to the course, first week you do nothing, and then say, yeah, well, I do 4 credits instead of 5. Then next week you still didn't do anything, and go, I'll do 3 credits instead of 5. And up till the final week when you can say, just, oh, well, it was just only 1 credit, I don't need that. So basically, try to manage your time. And if you can't, just, you know, teaching assistants can make you schedules or weekly schedules if you need. The course is very flexible, so just don't hang yourself with it. There's plenty enough rope, so you can do almost whatever you want during the course at your own pace, but try to make an organized tour through the course. Otherwise, you will get caught by that. And make groups. It can be quite tough alone if you just have no one there to motivate you, no one there to ask questions, except the TAs. It can be hard. So actually, you need to manage your time better than in other courses. Otherwise, it's very simple. Do all the exercises, but find out how you can actually pull that off by yourself. And all of the exercises. This usually sounds very scary to most of you. I mean, some of the exercises are going to be horrible and boring. You know, they are course exercises. They can't all be interesting. And if something doesn't interest you, you would rather do something awesome that you thought about. You have this nice computer game that you are programming or something like that. Yeah, if you do something that is nice, you do it in Haskell, we can grade that. So if you do some awesome project, we can, you know, mark some exercises for you, even if you didn't exactly do the exercise. But if you did equivalent project, you can get credit for that. But word of warning, though. Don't get caught up. It's easy to start making this huge, awesome project without knowing that much of Haskell, then spend 4 months and get nothing out of it. So don't get trapped in this if you try this. But if you feel confident you have programmed in Haskell before or you know that you can do that, please go ahead. It's probably going to be more fun than the plain exercises that I have. Yeah, And next topic. Any questions this far on this passing the course thing? Yeah, when I say any questions, I know that you have questions, but no one is actually willing to ask them, so just be brave if you have any. You can ask in Finnish also. No? Yes?
I can't ask in Finnish, but what happens if I don't do the exercise right, if I fail the exercise?
Ah, yeah.
Do you try it again? Or
yeah, you try again. So we grade each exercises as well as giving you feedback. And the exercise is done when it's done properly.
Okay.
So even if the exercise works and you have done it in a very strange way or some other way that we don't like, we are going to ask you to do it again and give you hints how to do it better. And this is going to happen for most of the exercises, hopefully. I mean, it's important that you get feedback. And if you have to redo an exercise, it's not a bad thing. It's a good thing because it's an opportunity to learn more stuff. Any more about? Okay, we are a bit tight on the schedule, so I'll paste through the slides. Okay, on the organization of this particular course instance, we had this nice thing that every one of you registered for the course, and we thought that there's probably going to be something like 40 people in the course, and well, not so much. So basically, the contact with the real world was a bit like this. We kind of didn't expect there to be so many of you. So basically 150 sign-ups. We have 3.5 members of teaching staff. Tommy is going to be here only for the first half. And my course model requires me to, you know, give feedback on each and every exercise that you make. And if you do the math, if every one of you 150 who have registered in this course does one exercise, it means that the TAs are going to spend, each and every TA and me, are going to spend 1 hour grading the exercise. And that is under the assumption that we take no more than 60 seconds to grade and give feedback, which is not going to happen. And classrooms. Originally, I had reservations for about 30. And basically, I can't fit you all physically in that classroom I had reserved. So I gave away that classroom and then told our amanuensis to get me any classroom or any set of classrooms that fits all of these people. We got delayed 1 week, so it took 1 week to settle this. And we got all the classrooms that no one else wanted for, you know, this period of the year. And by saying all, I mean all. There are very many small classrooms and you have to figure out that you can go to that supervised session or that supervised session, and you probably won't fit there, but you will fit there, and you know, the TAs will sort that thing out. So find these guys and ask them where you should be. The whole idea is you attend one lecture each week and hopefully attend at least 2 supervised sessions where there will be someone to help you to complete the exercises. And there is no logic in the classroom reservations. So usually we try to reserve that we have practice session 1, practice session 2, and so on. So we have these continuous, nice, logical weekly schedules. No, this course, we don't have them. We just got all the classrooms in all available times. So this is going to be a very big hassle, but, you know, don't panic. It's going to be fun also. Also, we get to walk uphill to the Liikunta building or the sports building where our lectures are. So we get a slight amount of sports by walking up the hill. And I'm really sorry about that, but that's the only option for now, that is. And the evil reality. My bosses have, you know, gotten this strange idea in their heads that I should be somehow a productive member of the university. And when I make courses like this, it's going to cost money. Paying these guys is not cheap. They're very expensive guys to hire. The classrooms actually cost the university the money. And when I make this course, I really, you know, have to earn that money somehow back to the university, or otherwise I can't make the courses, which is silly. But it leaves me 2 options. I can mitigate the costs by giving out as many credits as possible. And I can also mitigate the costs by writing publications or reporting surveys how you reacted to these weird course models that don't give you grades or exams. So there are two ways of me to earn virtual money that pays for the classrooms. And this means that it's quite important that you actually answer my surveys. So reacting to this evil reality, if I can't pass out credits or can't do publications, this course is going to be much smaller and have much less TAs, and it's not going to be as nice. So basically, I want you to learn for fun. Do this because it's interesting and a great topic, but do at least minimum of one credit. If you do at least one credit, I can have this course next year again and make it even better. And if you just can't do even one credit, send me an email saying that I can't do it because something. And that is data that I can use in my publications, and if I can do that, I can have a course next year also. Same goes with the surveys. If you answer the surveys, I can publish the data and, you know, have a nice course and spend even some time preparing it. Otherwise, next year, if we have this many people, there won't be any extra classrooms, and we all have to fit in this one 30-people classroom. So everyone is standing up and has actually 30 square centimeters of space in the classroom, which is not going to be nice. Another thing that I want to underline is make groups. Study in groups. It's going to be educational. It's going to make your studying much more easy. And also, you know, I would like to say that I won't grade any exercise that is done individually. I really don't want to say that. But I have to emphasize that if you, each and every one of you returns one exercise, it's going to be a huge amount of work for the TAs and me. But if you do it, for example, like this, you have a friend, both of you do the exercise even individually, then you compare. Comparing exercises is a very good way to learn also. Compare and see that this one is more interesting. We submit this and get feedback for this exercise. It actually halves our workload. And basically, we can give you better feedback if there's less exercise submitted. So please work in groups. And if at all possible, you know, return the answer sizes in groups of three or four. Two or three. Four is just too much. I don't want you to force yourself to work in groups all the time. So the course system is set up so that you can join and leave groups at any time, whenever you like. You can make new groups during the course. You can leave groups during the course. It's not a problem. And how you can make the groups? Well, we spend a little time at the end of this session to, you know, form preliminary study groups or show who your friends could be during the course. And use the course mailing list to gather friends if you don't find them other way. And yeah, returning the exercises. In addition to returning them in groups of two or three, since we try to review them all, try to be as clear as possible. So if you return this two-page piece of code, and we have to go and hunt line by line where the actual exercise is, you are going to get a very bad review because it's going to take more than the 60 seconds that we have allocated for this. Also, try to be concise. Concise and clear, and we promise to give you better feedback. If you make this huge ramble and we can't find out even where the exercise actually is, the feedback is not going to help you that much. No, tired reviewer, bad reviewer, and we are all going to be very tired at the end of the course. Okay, exercises in a real world. Any burning questions? None. You have? No. So, next up. I have told you quite much about what is the teaching philosophy in the course, how you practically work in the course. So now we get to the, you know, meat of the course. So you need to install some tools. How many of you have a laptop that you can bring to the class? Okay, let's try it other ways. How many of you don't have a laptop that you can bring into the class? To those people I recommend, go and buy one. They are not that expensive. But you don't have to bring a laptop if you don't really want. In the lectures, I ask you even to write small bits of code. So, it's nice to have a laptop and you can follow my slides if you have a laptop. And if I'm very boring, you can read, you know, newspapers on the laptop. So it's just win-win for you. And there are tools that you need to install to the said laptop. You need software called the Haskell platform. There's a link on the slide if you want. The slides will be posted to the course page. That gives you the Haskell compiler and basic libraries that you can use. Then you need a decent text editor. So if you can, you know, save plain text files, you are good. If you find something that is a bit better than Windows Notepad to do it, you are, you know, very well set up to pass this course. So we don't have any complicated tools here. Tools that you might want to try out, if you are very familiar with tools called Eclipse or Visual Studio or whatever, they have all kinds of plugins that allow you to use other languages like Haskell. So you might want to try these out. If you do try out these, notice that languages like Java or C Sharp, they are, you know, they're big business. They have, you know, billions of dollars are being spent on the tools for these languages. And the tools with Haskell, well, they are just hobby projects for two or three people. So don't expect to have the same great experience using Visual Studio to code Haskell than you would have to use Visual Studio to code C Sharp. So just be a bit wary, this might be somewhat rough. And if you don't want to install anything, there's even this FP-complete web integrated development environment that you can use directly through the browser. And it's quite nice. So you might want to try out. So that is what you need to install on your own laptop. And then there is quite a lot that I tried to make for you. So practically, if you start this course, you go to this address, functionalprogramming.id.jyu.fi, and you get this nice page. It explains pretty much everything that I just said, and also has this link on top right corner, which gives you the basic overview of the course tasks. Here is a list of hopefully all tasks that you actually have to do to pass the course. And you can see there's these nice boxes. Learn the basics. That's the first task that you have to do. Basically install the tools, get started, learn to use version control, find friends to study with, and so on. That's the first task. Then there is the first credit, where you learn about syntax, expressions, functions, data, and so on. And the idea is that if you complete all of these exercises in this block, then you get the credits for first credit. And here are the exercises for the second credit. Complete them all, you get the second credit, and so on. If you go to the very end of this list, you will see that I actually haven't completed the credit number 5 or 4 yet. So basically, I will complete these this week, and then you have all the course material done already. So you can just start from the top, work your way down, and the list should say when you have completed an exercise and when you haven't. Also, we have these nice other features that I would like to show you. Since most of the stuff that I hastily write for you and all these course topics that I write, I can spend something like 3 weeks to do the entire course. So it will be quite sloppily done at points. So I have added these give feedback links. So if you click here, you find that this chapter doesn't make any sense. Just point here, click, and tell me. If you type something here, it will be completely anonymous. I don't know who typed that, so you can be very critical, and I, you know, can't hunt you down. And, well, you type it, I get the message. I usually try to fix it within 1 or 2 days. So basically, if there's some exercise that you can't really understand what you're doing, click this. If there's some factual error, click this. If there's some mistake that you did an exercise, but it still doesn't say complete, click this button, and I'll know, and I can help you with that. Okay. Other things. I tried to make the course material slightly more interactive to support remote study. if there's someone who can't attend the lectures. So I made these things that, you know, there are question boxes. So if I explain something very complicated, I try to make a short multiple choice question right after that, so you can actually check if you did understand the topic. So you read something, then go and click this question answer thing, and then if you get anything wrong, go back and find out why it is wrong. So these help you to control your learning in a way that, you know when you understand stuff, and you get alerted if you don't understand something. Or you get alerted because I wrote the question wrong or, you know, made a typo there. Also, to improve the course material, I have these code examples, which have one additional feature that I added. If you see a small question mark in the code, it's not actual Haskell code. Haskell doesn't contain question marks in those places. But it means that you can put your mouse over the word with the question mark, and there is an added explanation behind that. So in this case, yeah, I'm putting my mouse there, and it says that this is a variable assignment. You know, everyone probably can guess that, but as an example, put word, the cursor over here, and it says this is a literal string, and so on. So there's a bit of these small explanations that are hidden away in the code examples. Then I have these interactive testing boxes where you can type Haskell expressions and see how they evaluate. So hopefully you can try to test the code as soon as you see it. The thing that you have to note about these is that you can't make new definitions in the code boxes. You can only evaluate expressions. So you can't do things like this. You can't assign new variables or make new variables or new definitions. So these are just for evaluating expressions. With Haskell, this actually gets you very far. Okay, next. If you return the exercises, you have to return them through this integrated exercise return system. So basically, whenever there's an exercise, you can just click a file, add your name here, and then add other guys who made the exercise with you, and then submit. So you don't have to email me or put your exercise online or whatever. Just don't trust this system to actually save your exercise. So make a backup copy, or otherwise it's going to be, you know, tears at the end of the course. Joo, kohta. And finally, there are these web exercise modules. Since there's many of you, I made an automatically created exercises. So you don't have to install anything, and you can just, you know, start hacking Haskell directly on the browser. And these are the things that you can do just by yourself, since they are automatically reviewed. So no one has to do any work. All the feedback you get is both instant and, you know, automatically generated. So you write code here, you read the assignment, then you press check, and then there's this notes section that pops up and says that there's these things that are wrong in your code and this result is unexpected. Then you go back, fix the code, and check it again until you get it. So those are all the tools that I have pre-made for you. There's one unfortunate bit about these tools, is that to actually identify who is making the exercises, we have this sign-in system, which is probably by the, you know, most horrible sign-in provider ever, called Mozilla Persona. This is a, you know, this usual login system that you type your email address to and then register for it, and then you can log into my course page. And this is probably going to, you know, cause some gray hairs during this course because it's actually very bad service. I just didn't have time to put something smarter there. If you don't want to give out your credentials for some weird Mozilla company, then you just make a throwaway email account and use that. And, well, this is kind of easy to use, so you won't probably have any troubles using that. Matti, did you have something about this login other than this?
Yeah,
Yeah, good. So, this is the basic tools that you will use during the course. And there are, you know, expected failure points. I spent exactly 2 weeks in making all of this, so I never tested if it actually works. So most commonly, though, I would expect that there are some bugs in it. If you find something that, you know, doesn't work, just let me know. And the most common thing is that if you make an exercise and, you know, do perfectly, and it still is saying missing in these links, then it means that I have made a typo in the list, and it's not actually your fault, but just something that you have to tell me. Also, loading this tasks page, if there's that many people doing the course, this might get slow. So if this page loads like forever, just let me know, send me an email and I'll fix it. Okay, hastily, everything that I've done for you in the web. Questions about this? I was probably very unclear when explaining, but things will get clear. Anything that is bothering you currently? No? Good. Additionally, how many of you know what IRC is? Yeah, great. Here is an IRC channel. If you didn't know what the IRC was, then look around you and find someone who has had their hand up. So ask someone. This is basically an online chat. All the TAs are required to be there 24/7. So you can ask during that time, any time during the week, anything about Haskell, and basically there's someone to answer you. So you have this, you know, full-time support for the course. And only rules in the behavior of this channel is you have to be polite, and you can't discuss about hugely advanced functional programming topics in order not to scare the, you know, part of the class who is really a beginner in this. So no scary discussions. And, you know this Latin saying, errare humanum est. In this course, it's more like errare villainem est. Because, you know, the course webpage will break. It's, you know, it's a horrible piece of software. It's no way that it can, you know, stay up the whole of this course. So it will break. The classroom reservations, yeah, I already broke those. So they don't work. But there is this happy thing. The course staff has this magical ability to unbreak things if you tell us when they are broken. So if things break, and they will break, let us know and have patience and we'll fix them. But just to know, they will break. Okay, course setup. No questions? Questions? Yes?
Where can I find the videos for the lectures?
Where do the videos for the lectures appear? In the task page. If you want to watch this lecture as a video, we will have a link here. So click that and, you know, it takes probably, you know, 1 day or so to get the video up, at least in the beginning before we get the routine of uploading videos to somewhere reliably. But they will appear here. Anything else? No one has their hand up. So I have spent half of my time and covered 1/5 of my topics, usual way of progressing in my lectures. So here is the part where I take this nasty tennis ball and break someone's laptop with. So I know why I learned functional programming, but as a just a snap check, why did you attend this course? What is your motivation? Why did you come here? Does anyone want to, you know, comment on this? Why are there so many people in my class? I really want to know. And since this is the usual Finnish classroom situation, everyone is going slightly under the table when I ask questions, I have this helpful ball that I'm going to throw, then you are going to hopefully catch it. And if you have the ball, you have to say something. And then you can throw the ball at some other unsuspecting victim, and he has to talk. So we'll try this now. So, and if you throw the ball at me, don't be very harsh, because it's very hard to catch.
It's his fault. It seems like a great way to build robust software.
Yeah. Saa puhua suomeksi. Yeah, one more and then we have to continue. Yes.
Well, it's a different take on programming, and I have a friend who does functional programming for a living, and he told me it's going to be the other thing. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's the most common cases. Some people go crazy about functional programming, and then they have to convert every one of their friends to use functional programming as well. Great. Keep the ball while we discuss. So. Basically, my answer, why would you want to learn functional programming? It's because it's fun. It's a fun way to program. That's my answer. And the longer answer is, it's a fun way to program. I think everyone who sits in this classroom are somehow programming aficionados. We like to program, we like to create things. And functional programming makes it more easy to create certain kinds of complex things, and it stretches your brain in a curious ways, so you get to learn new things all the time. I started about 10 years ago, and I'm still learning new abstractions, new things, and new ways to program. And if I had stayed in Java world, I wouldn't be learning new things now. 10 years is probably long enough to learn Java or C almost completely, so there won't be that many new stuff there, but functional programming seems to always generate these really crazy ideas that are fun and interesting. Another anecdote, since I use functional programming for all programming tasks that I do, and if functional programming wasn't a great tool to do it, I probably still wouldn't, even though it's fun to use. And here is an anecdote of how things in my world usually go. One time, I rewrote 250 lines of a 700-line program. More than a quarter of the lines of the program were changed. Then I was in a hurry. I did not execute my program. I just compiled it. And then I shipped it to my friend, who is responsible for, using the program. And that time, things worked. He didn't have to change anything in the program. He didn't even know that I didn't even write tests, nor did I even execute the program before I sent it out to the world. So, things worked that time. It was silly, but I was in a hurry. And basically what I'm saying is that if I had done this in pretty much any other language, if I had 700 lines of Python, and I would rewrite 200 lines of these, the resulting program would not work. At least I could not make it work. If I do this the same in Java, have 700-line Java program. Well, there's no 700-line Java programs. They're all like 7,000 lines of Java programs. But even in 7,000-line Java program, I change 200 lines. And if I don't test it, it will not work. Fact of life. I am not enough smart to make it work. But demonstrably, I have done this more than once with Haskell. So it has something that makes me more efficient. Or at least makes me make less mistakes. So how did Haskell actually enable me to pull off this really stupid stunt? Well, Haskell is usually described by three adjectives. Firstly, it's pure language. And pure means that in Haskell you don't have mutable variables. If you set x to, say, value 5, it will always have value 5. You can never change any variable value. So your program has no state. There's no internal state in your program. There are no untracked side effects. So if you compute a function in Haskell, it's never going to print anything to the console. It's never going to send packages through the internet. It's not going to do any kind of an effect without you being explicit that you want an effect. So it allows me some kind of control there. Then it's strongly typed. And I can't really actually explain deeply why strongly typed is good before you have tried it yourself. I will discuss a bit later. And finally, it's functional. If I make a program in Python or Java, I usually make a sequence of statements that describe how something is computed. If I make a program in Haskell, I don't declare what the steps are to get the result, I declare what the result is. So I describe what the result should look like, and the compiler will figure out for me how that is actually computed. And, you know, it also makes the code much more easier to reason about. I don't have to, you know, think about the order of statements that I have in my code. I can just, you know, say that give me thing that looks like this, and out it comes. Finally, another aspect of word functional is that functions are values. So you can use functions like you would use integer or thing like this in any other programming language. So as a first benefit, I said that Haskell is pure. It doesn't have mutable variables and doesn't have program state. And why is avoiding program state and mutable variables a nice thing instead of a thing that makes life more hard? Is how many of you have ever had this experience that you have to restart your computer or a, you know, single piece of software after it goes wonky? It doesn't behave right and you reboot the computer, you know. Yes, almost everyone. And that is program state. If you have a program that, you know, fails to work as it should be, you work for it with it for a while, then suddenly it starts doing strange stuff. It means that the program state has been corrupted. Some bit in the memory of the computer isn't where it's supposed to be, and things don't work as well. So that is program state. In Haskell, we don't have program state, so our programs won't go crazy at some point, usually. Another aspect, I attend these computer science education conferences, and I met this person called Juha Sorva from University of Helsinki. He had this enormously nicely done PhD. And in his PhD, he stated that people have most difficulty in understanding hidden state of the programs, variables, variable interactions, implicit state, and so on. Those are the difficulties, according to Juha, that plague, you know, beginner programmers. Those are things that are hard to understand in programs. So if you don't have, you know, hidden state, your programs will be easier to understand. So avoiding side effects and state. So less bugs, you know, there will be less bugs if you write Haskell code. It's almost a fact. You still get bugs, but they are at least interesting bugs. Almost everything can be tested in isolation. You know, if you have developed a bigger object-oriented program, to test a one class, you have to build something like 2 dozen other classes so that one class will work. In functional programming, you can just take individual function, wherever it appears, and test that in isolation. And that is enormously great thing to have, because then you can just test all bits of your code very efficiently. You don't have to have huge amount of work of setting up your test cases and so on. Then I will make a claim. This is my claim. I claim that functional programs are more modular and more reusable than object-oriented programs, almost regardless of the object-oriented language. Object orientation is, it's a nice thing. I'm not saying it's a bad way to program, but I'm saying that functional programming is much more modular than object-oriented programming. I have almost never seen an object-oriented program where I can just pick up one of the classes and just start using it in another different program. I also have almost never seen a functional program that doesn't contain at least one reusable part. So I would claim that. And it could be easier to learn when you are a beginner. I have no empirical evidence, and I don't know. I'll probably test it in the future, but might be. So these are the high-level things. In practice, if you write programs without using mutable variables, you get all kinds of these nice things as a side effect. You don't have null reference errors. You don't have null pointers. You can get them if you really dig deep down, but as default, you don't have them. You don't have to do a single typecast to work with Haskell. You don't have any of these identity versus equality issues. How many of you know JavaScript? Yeah, those who know JavaScript, you know that you compare objects, you use either one equal sign, two equal sign, or three equal signs, and they all mean different things. And if we don't have mutability in our language, they are all the same thing. Things like const, final, static, and those, you know, don't exist. Also, since Haskell is, you know, geared for making functions, you know, we don't have to write a lot of this extra code. We can just be very concise. And also, we can test our code directly as we write it, so we don't have to compile it in between. So, that's purity. I said it was pure, functional, and strongly typed. Functional means, well, like object-oriented programming, no one actually knows what functional means. But in my interpretation, it means this. In functional languages, functions are values. Functions can be stored in data structures, they can be passed as parameters, and that is actually a huge boost to modularity. You can write other functions that have missing parts, and then you can fill in the missing parts later when you use the functions. And they are actually the most powerful data structure that you can ever have. So if you have a language that doesn't allow you to pass functions as values, change the language. That's honestly my opinion. It doesn't have to be Haskell, but something that has this. Strongly typed. Anyone who really likes Python or Ruby or JavaScript? Yeah, my TAs. Then this is actually a slide that I don't need, since usually people see static typing. They see languages like Java where you have to write with every variable that this is an int, this is a string, this is an int, and so on. And that is actually very frustrating and doesn't help you to catch that many bugs. Unlike Java, Haskell has a very strong type system. It's a type system that allows you to be very precise how you want your programs to work. And if you write code that doesn't uphold this specification you give, it won't compile. So the type system is also flexible. So all things that you write in, say, Python or JavaScript, they can be given proper types in Haskell. So it doesn't get in your way either that much. And this is insanely powerful for catching bugs, but you really have to try it before you understand why. Okay. That's the bird's eye view on Haskell. Usually the most common question that I have when I have this course is that why do I use Haskell during the course? And the real answer is, of course, because I like Haskell. But the good answer is that Haskell is, it's a kind of language laboratory. It was born in, you know, late 80s as a committee language. Basically, at late 80s, there were plenty of people who were interested in functional programming and developing functional programming systems, and they decided that we need a common platform that we can all try our features on. So it's a language laboratory. It's not a production language. It's a language where scientists try to, you know, test out these new and strange ideas that they have about programming. So it's, in a sense, in one part of the world, it's a kind of a cutting edge of the science also. A new feature that will appear to Haskell before any other language. No, more, many new features, not all. And the choice of Haskell is not to say that Haskell is only functional programming language worth learning. It is that, you know, Haskell covers much ground. We have laziness, we have, you know, strong typing, we have, you know, purity, all in the same language, so we can just learn that and use the knowledge in other languages as well. And, yeah, at this point, you are either very bored of my monologue or dying to see what this miracle language actually looks like. So let's have a few examples. Very small, and you don't have to understand them yet, but at the end of the course, they will be clear as crystal. So, a simple example, you do this in every programming course, I guess. How do you count words in a string? So, if you have a string that goes, cat sits on a wall, you have five words there. probably 5, I didn't count them. Yeah. And in Java, if you write this simple function, it looks basically a bit like this. You have these few auxiliary variables, then you have this for loop, and then you have this if inside the for loop that has 3 branches, and there's some kind of counters, falses, conditions, and so on. This is how you count number of words in a string using Java. Any Java fans here? You know, hands up if you like Java. Because this is a thing that you, people usually complain to me about. I kind of diss Java all the time in my courses. I know it's a very practical language, and I know you can write great software in Java, but it's a nice point to contrast Haskell with. So if I diss Java, it doesn't mean that I actually, you know, say that you are bad people because you use Java. No, you might be great people and still use Java. I don't know. But okay, this is how you count the number of words in a string with Java. And no kidding, people actually write it like this. You know, check the answer for Stack Overflow in the exact question, how do you do this? And people do that. You know, isn't this a bit ridiculous? I just want, you know, count the words, and I have to write, you know, almost enough code that doesn't fit on one slide. So, same in Haskell. So, the big lump of code that we had above boils down to these, you know, what is the 5 symbols in one line. So that is how you count the number of words in Haskell. And it allows me to demonstrate this interpreter box also. So this is actual code. This is actually a way how you can do it. If you want to use the exact syntax I give in the example, I can write it like this. You don't yet have to know what the dot is, but just to show you that it works. So comparing and contrasting, this is what Haskell is actually giving me. Instead of writing this, I get to write this. And this is not just a special example of how things go. This is the general case. If I have a Java program that's this long, it's usually 1 or 2 lines in Haskell. In many cases, not all. So I get by without, you know, wearing out my keyboard as fast as I would while using Java. So, kind of being slightly unfair to the Java programmers in the classroom, you can actually write the same code in Java as I wrote in Haskell. You have extra lines there and some other things, but almost the same. But for some reason, people in Java really don't do it. They say that, yeah, for performance reasons, I can't do this. It's not Java style, I can't do this. And other these kind of fake reasons. And this is something that I want to teach in my course. So if you look at this Haskell solution, it has 5 symbols. How many mistakes can you have in this code? I mean, there's really no place to hide a bug in this one line. It's almost impossible to do really wrong. Now compare to this code. Let's say that I was mean, and when I prepared these slides, I changed one character in this code, and now it's wrong. Anyone can spot which character it is. So you get what I'm meaning with when I say that shorter code is better. Yeah. So that's the difference between functional and modern language to a rather old language like Java. And here is the neat Java code. You could write it in either of these 2 ways that are not much more, you know, wordy than in Haskell. First way is that you can use a ready-made class and have that do your problem for you. This is actually cheating since, you know, if you look at the implementations of these count tokens that you find in Java library, you get a piece of code that is, you know, much more horrible than this one. So it's not, you know, actually working. It's not doing the same thing. The definition is still hairy, even if it has been given a nice name. Unlike the Haskell solution, which I can compose from functions length and words, this doesn't give me length and words. I can use this only for single purpose. In Haskell, I have these two functions, and I have multiple purposes for each, and I can combine them if necessary. So this is slightly inferior. Or you can write this. This is the straightforward solution. You take the string, you just split the string and count the length of the words, exactly like I did in Haskell. Have you taken our, you know, Programming 1 course by Vesa Lappalainen? Who has? You know, if you take this solution and send it to Vesa Lappalainen and say that this is my solution, he's not going to give you full marks. He's going to say, no, don't do that. And why he says that is that this actually is very much more inefficient than the original for loop with the three-pronged if. Because this thing, it takes the whole string, if it's a long string, it allocates a big array that has as its elements all the words in the, you know, original string. So it's going to consume twice the memory that the Haskell solution is. It's not composable. If you have a, you know, say 100 megabyte string, you have, you know, some encyclopedia or something that you're splitting into words, it's going to cost you 200 megabytes in the memory or a bit more, whereas the Haskell solution runs in constant memory. So we quite don't reach the same conciseness with Java. Okay, more examples. One thing that usually strikes people in a strange way when they are learning Haskell is that Haskell is a non-strict, or in other words, lazy language. Like before, I told you that in Haskell solution, if you split the string into words and then count the words, it's not going to split the whole string. It's going to split the, you know, first word out of the string, count that, then split the second, and so on. So in Haskell, you only evaluate things when you need to evaluate things. And this allows us to have infinite structures. It allows us to say that here is a list that contains all positive numbers, from 1 to whatever number you want. So it's infinite lists. If you want any number you specify, it's going to be in that list. And we can operate on these infinite structures. So we have all the positive numbers. We take all the even numbers from the positive numbers, and we have all positive even numbers. And it's a list, and we can do whatever we want with the list, even though it has infinite number of elements inside. Only problem is that if we, you know, try to count the length of that list, then our program is going to take, you know, quite a while to complete. The infinite structures, they are this bit of a, you know, stage trick. They are neat, but they are not that much used. This non-strict semantics is more about having extra modularity in our code. For example, this simple example of counting, you know, the number of words. Haskell doesn't split the words in one big array of individual words. It just splits off the first word, counts it, say, this was the first one, throws the word away, takes the second one, yeah, this is the second word, and so on. So it never allocates all of this array of all words in the string. So in Haskell, you can write concise code, and you still get constant memory use. So you get something that is quite efficient, even though it's modular. Another example is, you know, counting the words is probably a bit artificial. I show you another piece of Haskell code. And this is an implementation of a very simple function, which says, given a predicate P and a list of some elements called list, is there any element in the list that the predicate matches? So, for example, I can do things like this. In this list, is there any element that is less than 5? And it says true. And in this list of all positive numbers, is there any number that is more than 15? And I get true. And let's say I want some. Yeah, does this list have any elements that are greater than 50? No. So this is a nice example of how Haskell is compositional. In Java, if you wrote a function to check if all the elements match some predicate in a list, you would first think very hard how you represent the predicates. If you are using new enough Java, you can actually pass a function as a parameter and you get this. Then you would probably just write a for loop. You would write a big loop that checks every element in the list. Instead, in Haskell, I can, you know, compose two things. I have this function map, applies my predicate to all elements in the list. I get list that contains, you know, true and false, true, true, false, and so on. And then I have this other function called OR, which says that is there any true values in the list. So I can use this to compose kind of a new control structure. Like you saw before, this any function, it does work for infinite lists, so it doesn't evaluate the whole list. So I can make things like this. And it only evaluates as many elements as needed. So I can build my own control structures that, you know, check only this part of the list, that part of the list, and never evaluate everything. And this is why the non-strictness in the language is good. Suppose the language wasn't strict. Then this part, where we check each element of the list with the predicate p, if the list was very long, we would have to compute the p for every element in the list. If there was 1 million elements in the list, it would compute p for every element of the list, even if the first element would match. But since we are not strict, if the first element matches, we never have to compute anything else. Basically, I see at least three worried faces in the lecture hall. So these are all examples. You are not supposed to know exactly how they work. Next week you will know exactly how they work, but not yet. So no worries. It will all become clear. Yeah, that's why non-strictness is good. Then the strong type system. I'll show you a small example of how types in Haskell work. Let's say we have a function that removes some elements that we don't want from the list and keeps those that we want. The same function that we used for defining a list containing all positive even numbers a few slides back. I'm not going to show you the definition of this function. I'm just going to show you the type. And this first line with two colons in the middle, that's a type declaration. And this small bit is my specification. It tells me what this function can do and with what kind of value it will do it. You can contrast this to the, you know, method declaration lines in Java where you have this definitions of these values. This parameter is an int, this is a bool, and so on. What this line says, filter is a function that takes another function as a parameter. This is the predicate. This is thing that allows me to check if A is thing I want or is the thing I don't want. Then it takes a list of type A, so list of elements A, and returns a list of elements of type A. And this first thing to note is that this works for lists containing whatever elements. So if I have lists of integers, if I know to say that this integer is the integer I want, I can use this function. If this list contains, say, you know, some ice cream data type or truck or email, the function will still work. I just have to be able to say which are the emails that I want or which are the ice cream recipes I want. It all works. What else is hidden in here? There is this nice fact. Since this has to work for all types A that I care to use it for, this actually says that all the elements of the output list have to come from the input list. Because, you know, it has to work for any elements. The implementer of this function doesn't know which elements it's operating on. So only place where it can get those values is from the input list. And we don't even have to look at the code to know this. Also, types are used for tracking effects in Haskell. So, like I said before, that Haskell functions can never print to the console or send network packages or do stuff like this. Haskell, of course, has facility to do all these things. But instead of functions, we have types like I/O that declare that this thing, when executed, can actually do something strange. It can communicate to the world. It can print to the console, it can read from the keyboard. And it's visible on the types. This thing, it can, you know, print to the console and can do input-output things. This function, there is no I/O flag there. It can never, you know, print to the console. There will be no side effects from running this. So I can track which parts of my code are effectful, which parts are interacting with the user and so on, which allows me to separate those parts from the pure parts, which makes the program very easy to test because pure code is easy to test. Yeah, so few tasty bits of, you know, starter Haskell. Probably weren't that interesting, but any questions about these? No questions about these. Have I started mumbling yet? Can you still understand me? Yeah, great. And then we have time for a really short introduction to the following week. So I will quickly go over what I'm really looking for you to learn during this week. So goals for this week. After this week, you should be able to, you know, understand the concept of computation as calculation. I will explain in 3 minutes what that is. And most importantly, I want you to be able to read Haskell syntax. Haskell has a very strange syntax, so you have to spend a little while to get accustomed to that. So you have to be able to recognize operators like plus, minus, times, and so on. You have to be able to see what is a function call, what is not a function call, what is an addition, and so on. You have to recognize that this is actually a computation, this is a type declaration. So basically, you should be able to read Haskell by end of this week, at least in a rudimentary way. So those are the goals. First goal was understanding programs as a calculation. This is actually one of the sources of, you know, this high expressivity and usefulness of Haskell. Here is a Java program. And each Java program is, in a sense, made up from, you know, sequence of statements. This statement says that take the bit in the memory of the computer, which the UI refers to, and add something. And then take the bit where the x points to and increment it by 1. Then take the bit where z points to and set that value to square root of y plus x. And finally, when you are done, print something. So these are consecutive statements. Do this, do this, do this. When you are done, do this. And that's the Java or imperative way of programming. Then there are other things. There are expressions like the square root y plus x or square root y plus 1 times x or whatever. These are expressions. They represent some value. They don't do anything. They just evaluate to a value. And in Haskell, we don't focus on the statements. The statements are, they are there, but we use them as little as possible. We focus on expressions. And expressions tell us what to calculate, not how. And this is actually quite a useful trick. Since I'm running out of time, I won't actually show you the example that I promised you. My TAs will show you how to do this example after the class. So why focusing on expressions is good? If you look at a Java code, for example, the string splitting code that I showed you, you must make a mental simulation of the computer running that code. To see what the code is doing, you have to, you know, keep in your mind all the variables, see how the variables change when the program is executed, and it's actually a very hard task. You have to become the computer for a short while to understand what the program is doing, and we are people, not computers, so it's very hard. But if you only have expressions, you don't have statements that force you to simulate what the computer is doing and what is in the memory of computer, you can just compute. Example, I show you quite a few of examples like this. Basically, first time when you see this, it's a huge wall of code that is scary. But, you know, get over it. This is actually a very simple thing. Every time you see something that looks like this, you should go, yay, this is thing I can actually read and understand. So don't get scared of this. So what is happening in my code? I can actually take this expression that I showed you earlier as an example. And I can actually compute this by using just pen and a paper, or a text editor or whatever. I can take this expression in Haskell, then I can find out that I had this definition for function any. I gave you the definition earlier. Any plist equals or map plist. Then I have to just do this thing where I check that any plist equals something. Okay, here's any. This is probably the p and this must be the list. So if I replace p with this and the list with this, I get something like this. So basically, this is exactly the same process that you used in, you know, basic school or, you know, kindergarten when you computed complex mathematical expressions. Just search and replace. Then we have this complex expression. We no longer actually know what it's doing. We find definition for map. Map in Haskell means that do this for all these elements in the list. So yeah, we get a list with these conditions inside. And then since we are smart and human, we find out that, hey, this first condition is true, so we evaluate that. And then we know that if any of these things is true, this function or will return a value true. So this means the same as true. The interesting points on this thing is that I don't have the mutable state. I can look at each of these lines in isolation. If I see only this line in the middle, I can still compute it. I don't have to remember anything. So this makes it much more easy to understand. And we could go deeper and calculate by hand how the map actually works or how the, you know, OR function actually works. And why am I doing these, you know, forcing you actually to do this by hand, is that this actually tells you everything how the program works. You follow through these steps. You will have an explanation for each transformation of the program. If you read this carefully through, you can't fail to understand how the program works. It will be so obvious. You don't have to simulate a machine, just compute. Anytime you see a strange small Haskell expression, compute by hand, and then you know how it works. I mean, any expression almost. And you can always have this way of finding out what the program does without huge hassle. So, we do this by hand. I force each and every one of you to do at least 5 of these nasty calculations. I think that this will be likely boring after the first one. I know it's boring, but I think it's also good for you. It's an easy way to see how things work, and it kills this phenomenon called the superbug. Has anyone heard about superbugs yet? That is, no one has. Superbug is a word that I came across in one conference about computer science education. It describes, I think, the most prevalent mistake that people who don't know how to program think about programs. If you go to your first programming course, you probably had superbug, and the superbug is not in your code, it's in your head. And basically, the superbug is a misconception that students have that the computer is somehow benevolent and has some aim of helping you. So students usually write some code and, you know, hope that the computer, you know, does the right thing because it's friendly. And computers are definitely not friendly at all. So people fail to program in even simple ways. They write something and they hope that the computer understands it the right way. If you are forced to do the derivation business, you can see how the computer works. You can't anymore assume that it does something smart because you have to, you know, pretend to be the computer for a while. Oh, yeah. Any comments on the derivations business? I know that you will be bored doing this, but do it anyway. I find it very educational.
Any? No? Good. Then a word about syntax of Haskell. That was the learning goal number two that you have to learn. And what you need to know is that Haskell's syntax is, it's very flexible. It's, you know, you saw the few examples. It looks like this strange moon language. You know, it doesn't make any sense when you first see it. And, you know, you can arrange, you know, basically take any bit of code and shuffle it around in any way you like. And it's still going to be kind of a Haskell program. The type checker will say that, you know, I won't compile this, but it's still a syntactically valid Haskell program. So these are results in this situation where I find that in every instance of my course, there are a few prevalent mistakes that everyone makes. And this year, you know, the course material is designed to point out these mistakes to you, and in hopes that no one has to make them over and over again. After you get used to the syntax, it's very nice, but in the beginning you get hit by, you know, things like this. Here are a few example function calls in Haskell and in Java. And just, you know, the idea is that on the left side you have Haskell, how it's written in Haskell, on the right side how you would write it in Java. I'm assuming that everyone knows a bit of Java or C or whatever language that looks like that. And the first difficulty is that function calls or function applications. In Haskell, we just, you know, write them function name, first argument, second argument, and that's the function call. In Java, we would write the arguments inside parentheses. In Haskell, this is actually nice to read, and it's faster to type. You don't have to type the parentheses and so on. And it works very nicely until the student first encounters an expression like this. So in this case, the student probably wanted to take argtan of, you know, x and y times 2. Anyone know what this atan function is? Okay, I chose that very badly. This is just some trigonometric function. It's calculating what is the angle between two sides of a triangle and so on. Just, it does something, it's a function. Don't care about what it actually does. So, in Haskell, you would expect that this function is passed two arguments, x and y times 2. Instead, this is the only part that is inside the function call. 8 and 2 gets x and y, and then the whole bit is multiplied by 2. The rule is that everything before an operator symbol eventually gets passed as an argument for a function. Operators don't, they end the argument list. So this whole thing is same as this. This multiplication here takes the whole left part and 2 as arguments. Then we have another instance of this. Same problem, and if I would get a penny every time that someone makes this mistake in my course, I would be very rich and I could buy something like 50 TAs for the money. So consider the final example. In this case, we have this function again, and the student probably has tried to give it as a parameters x and asin y. What it actually means is that this atan function is now given 3 parameters, one of them which is a function. And this is really not at all what you were supposed to be writing. So basically, it's easy to confuse cases like 6 and 7. Well, it's not so easy to find out how the parentheses work. So I want you to spend, you know, a few hours this week and really figure out how this thing works. What are the things that get passed as an argument for a function and what are not things? If you get over this, the rest of the Haskell syntax is, I think, very easy. It's an indentation-based syntax, like in Python, means that we make groups by indenting the code instead of brackets and so on, but that's all easy. This is the difficult part. Questions? I finished my, you know, horrendous monologue. Any questions? Are you all dreadfully bored? Please nod. Yeah, you're all dreadfully bored, so we can go on, no questions at all. So next, we take a few minutes to form preliminary study groups, and the TAs will explain you the whole mess with the classrooms and show you where you have to be and when you have to be. So if you are, you know, anxious to leave, don't leave just now. We will take a few minutes. So how I would like you to make the study groups. You can, of course, study with your friend. That is okay. But I find it that it's very beneficial to study with people who are approximately the same skill level as you are. So we do this up and down dance here to discover who are the potential friends for you. So this is not to discriminate you at all. This is just to help you study. First step, everyone who feels uncomfortable as programmers, you have done quite little programming, you never really felt comfortable with it, you haven't taken math, you definitely haven't done anything with Haskell, just stand up for a little while. You know, anyone who feels a bit uncomfortable with the whole programming thing. And this is not a, you know, this is not a judgment. Other people have just passed the stage where you are. You will pass it and you will be even more great programmers. Okay, take a look around. There's four people who are, you know, a bit scared about the whole thing. I suggest that you four, you know, make a group. You are all at the same boat. You know all about these, you know, things that could be difficult and you can discuss in the same language. Great. And also we have this extra practice session that is specifically for you. Just take a look and, you know, team up after the thing. Okay, next. Please sit down. If you have, you know, programmed in a functional language, have taken advanced mathematics, or you just feel that you are so extremely good programmer that you don't need advanced mathematics, just please stand up. You have more than 5 years of programming experience, you have done math, you feel all around comfortable, you have done any Haskell or any other functional programming, even a little bit. Please just... Yeah, great. Why are all my TAs sitting down? That's worrisome. Okay, take a look. You are probably a good team. And for the rest of you, you should be all on the same level. So look around, see anyone, and make a small team out of that. The TAs will help you and get things started. Yeah, that's all that I plan to tell you this today. Any questions at this time? No questions. Then let the chaos and confusion of starting a new course begin. And note that there will be all sorts of difficulties and broken software during this course, but that doesn't matter a single bit. Just have fun. And before you leave, talk to the TAs. They will instruct you on where you should go, which sessions you should attend. Basic rule, attend all the lectures, attend at least 2 supervised sessions every week. And thank you for attending.
Mä lähden liikkeelle, kun mulla on se 3 pistettä viime syksyllä tehtyä.
Missä?
Joo.
Saat.
Ja sulla on 2 vaihtoehtoa. Pistä sitä.
Hei, onnaka hetki.
For the first few weeks, we will have parallel sessions. So the one starting right after this session will be held in, I think, Soviet and Lakes. So, in Soviet, someone will be in Lakes. I would suggest that once you perform groups between yourselves, you will, with your group, stay in the sessions of the single PA. So you follow that PA around. Happen in a couple of weeks. We haven't yet sorted out who will take which rooms, but at least for the first few weeks we'll be architecting the Soviet, someone will take place, and probably, I think, in the Friday sessions.